Chapter 10. The Shape of Things. When wizards find a new thing, they play with it. So do scientists. They play with ideas so wild that often they seem to defy common sense, and then they insist that those ideas are right and common sense isn't. They often make out a surprisingly good case. Einstein once said something nasty about common sense being akin to nonsense, but he went too far. Science and common sense are related, but indirectly. Science is something like a third cousin of common sense, twice removed. Common sense tells us what the universe seems like to creatures of our particular size, habits, and disposition. For instance, common sense tells us that the Earth is flat. It looks flat, leaving out the hills, valleys, and other bumps and dents. If it wasn't flat, things ought to roll around or fall off. Despite this, the Earth isn't flat. On Discworld, in contrast, the relation between common sense and reality is usually very direct indeed. Common sense tells the wizards of Unseen University that Discworld is flat, and it is. To prove it, they go to the edge, as Rincewind and Twoflower do in The Colour of Magic, and watch stuff disappearing over it in Rimfall. The roaring was louder now. A squid bigger than anything Rincewind had seen before broke the surface a few hundred yards away and thrashed madly with its tentacles before sinking away. They were running out of world. Then they can be trapped in the circumference, a 10,000-mile-long net just below the edge, one tiny bit of which is patrolled by Tethys, the sea troll, and they can peer over the edge. The scene beneath him flipped into a whole new terrifying perspective, because down there was the head of an elephant, as big as a reasonably sized continent. Below the elephant, there was nothing but the distant, painful disk of the sun, and sweeping slowly past it was something that, for all its city-sized scales, its craterpox, its lunar cragginess, was indubitably a flipper. It is widely imagined that ancient people thought the Earth was flat, for all those obvious common-sense reasons. Actually, most ancient civilizations that left records seem to have worked out that the Earth has to be round. Ships came back from invisible lands over the horizon, and in the sky, a round sun and a round moon were a definite clue. Most civilizations is admittedly not the same as most people. Most people, through the history of the planet, have not needed to concern themselves with what shape the world is, provided it supports somewhere the next meal. That's where science and common sense overlap. Science is common sense applied to evidence. Using common sense in that manner, you often come to conclusions that are very different from the obvious common sense assumptions, that because the universe appears to behave in some manner, then it really does. Of course, it also helps to realize that if you live on a very big sphere, it's going to look pretty flat for quite a long way off. And if gravity always points towards the middle of the sphere, then things don't actually roll around or fall off. But those are refinements. Around 250 BC, a Greek called Eratosthenes tested the theory that the Earth is a sphere, and he even worked out just how big that sphere is. He knew that in the city of Syene, present-day Aswan in Egypt, the midday sun could be seen reflected in the bottom of a well. This would not work in Ankh-Morpork, where the well water is often more solid than the well that surrounds it. Eratosthenes threw in a few other simple facts and got back a lot more than he'd bargained for. It's a matter of geometry. The well was dug straight down, so the sun at Syene had to be straight up, dead overhead. But in Eratosthenes' home city of Alexandria, in the Nile Delta, that didn't happen. At midday, when the sun was at its highest, Eratosthenes cast a definite shadow. In fact, he estimated that at noon the angle between the sun and the vertical was just over 7 degrees, near enough 1/50th of 360 degrees. Then came the leap of deduction. The sun is in the same place wherever you observe it from. On other grounds, it was known that the sun had to be a long way away from the Earth, and that meant that the sun's rays that hit the ground in Alexandria were very nearly parallel to those that went down the well in Syene. Eratosthenes reasoned that a round Earth would explain the difference. He deduced that the distance from Syene to Alexandria must be 1/50th of the circumference of the Earth. But how far was that? On such occasions, it pays to be familiar with the camel herders. Not just because the greatest mathematician in the world is the camel called You Bastard, as it is on Discworld, see Pyramids, but because the camel trains from Alexandria to Syene took 50 days to make the trip, at an average speed of 100 stadia per day. So the distance from Alexandria to Syene was 5,000 stadia, and the circumference of the Earth was 250,000 stadia. The stadium was a Greek measure of distance, and nobody knows how long it was. Scholars think it was 515 feet, 157 meters, and, if they're right, Eratosthenes' value was 24,662 miles, 39,690 kilometers. The true value is about 24,881 miles, 40,042 kilometers. So Eratosthenes got amazingly close. Unless, sorry, but we're incorrigibly suspicious, the scholars worked backwards from the answer. It is here that we encounter another feature of scientific reasoning. In order to make comparisons between theory and experiment, you have to interpret the experiment in terms of your theory. To clarify this point, we recount the story of Ratonostictenes, an early relative of Cut-Me-Own-Throat Dibbler, who proved that the Discworld was round and even estimated its circumference. Ratonostictenes noticed that at midday in the Ramtops the sun was overhead, whereas in Lancrey, some 1,000 miles away, it was at 84 degrees to the vertical. Since 84 degrees is roughly a quarter of 360 degrees, Ratonostictenes reasoned that the Discworld is round, and the distance from the Ramtops to Ankh-Morpork is one quarter of the circumference. That puts the circumference of this spherical Discworld at 4,000 miles, 6,400 kilometers. Unfortunately for this theory, it was known on other grounds that Discworld is some 10,000 miles, 16,000 kilometers, from rim to rim. Still, you can't let an awkward fact get in the way of a good theory, and Ratonostictenes went to his grave believing that it was a small world after all. His error was to interpret perfectly good observational data in terms of a flawed theory. Scientists repeatedly returned to established theories to test them in new ways, and tend towards testiness with those priests, religious or secular, who know the answers already, whatever the questions are. Science is not about building a body of known facts. It is a method for asking awkward questions and subjecting them to a reality check, thus avoiding the human tendency to believe whatever makes us feel good. From the earliest times, humans have been interested not just in the shape of the world, but in the shape of the universe. To begin with, they probably thought that these were the same question. Then they worked out, using roughly the same sort of geometry as Eratosthenes, that those lights in the sky were a very long way away. They came up with an amazing range of myths about the sun god's fiery chariot and so on, but after the Babylonians got the idea of making accurate measurements, their theories started to lead to surprisingly good predictions of things like eclipses and the motion of the planets. By the time of Ptolemy, Claudius Ptolemaeus, AD 100 to 160, the best model of planetary motion involved a series of epicycles. The planets moved as if they were rotating round circles, whose centres rotated round other circles, whose centres rotated round... Isaac Newton replaced this theory, and its more accurate successors, with a rule, the law of gravity. It describes how each body in the universe attracts every other body. It explained Johannes Kepler's discovery that planetary orbits are ellipses, and in the fullness of time, it explained a lot of other things too. After a few centuries of stunning success, Newton's theory ran into its first big failure. It made incorrect predictions about the orbit of Mercury. The place in its orbit at which Mercury came closest to the Sun didn't move quite the way Newton's law predicted. Einstein came to the rescue with a theory based not on attractive forces, but on geometry, on the shape of space-time. This was the celebrated theory of relativity. The theory came in two flavors, special relativity and general relativity. Special relativity is about the structure of space, time, and electromagnetism. General relativity describes what happens when you throw in gravity too. The main point is to appreciate that relativity is a silly name. The whole point of special relativity is not that everything is relative, but that one particular thing, the speed of light, is unexpectedly absolute. The thought experiment is well known. If you're travelling in a car at 50 miles per hour, 80 kilometers per hour, and you fire a gun forwards so that the bullet moves at 500 miles per hour, 800 kilometers per hour, relative to the car, then it will hit a stationary target at a speed of 550 miles per hour, 880 kilometers per hour, adding the two components. However, if, instead of firing the gun, you switch on a torch, which fires light at a speed of 670 million miles per hour, 186,000 miles per second, or 300,000 kilometers per second, then that light will not hit the stationary target at a speed of 670 million and 50 miles per hour. It will hit it at 670 million miles per hour, exactly the same speed as if the car had been stationary. There are practical problems in staging that experiment, but less graphic and dangerous ones have indicated what the result would be. Einstein published Special Relativity in 1905, along with the first serious evidence for quantum mechanics and a groundbreaking paper on diffusion. A lot of other people, among them the Dutch physicist Hendrik Lorentz and the French mathematician Henri Poincaré, were working on the same idea, because electromagnetism didn't entirely agree with Newtonian mechanics. The conclusion was that the universe is a lot weirder than common sense tells us, although they probably didn't use that actual word. Objects shrink as they approach the speed of light. Time slows down to a crawl. Mass becomes infinite. And nothing can go faster than light. Another key idea was that space and time are to some extent interchangeable. The traditional three dimensions of space, plus a separate one for time, are merged into a single unified space-time with four dimensions. A point in space becomes an event in space-time. In ordinary space, there is a concept of distance. In special relativity, there is an analogous quantity called the interval between events, which is related to the apparent rate of flow of time. The faster an object moves, the slower time flows for an observer sitting on that object. This effect is called time dilation. If you could travel at the speed of light, time would be frozen. One startling feature of relativity is the twin paradox, pointed out by Paul Langevin in 1911. Again, it is a classic illustration. Suppose that Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are born on Earth on the same day. Rosencrantz stays there all his life, while Guildenstern travels away at nearly light speed and then turns round and comes home again. Because of time dilation, only 1 year, say, has passed for Guildenstern, whereas 40 years have gone by for Rosencrantz. So Guildenstern is now 39 years younger than his twin brother. Experiments carrying atomic clocks around the Earth on jumbo jets have verified this scenario, but aircraft are so slow compared to light that the time difference observed, and predicted, is only the tiniest fraction of a second. So far so good, but there's no place yet for gravity. Einstein racked his brains for years until he found a way to put gravity in. Let space-time be curved. The resulting theory is called general relativity, and it is a synthesis of Newtonian gravitation and special relativity. In Newton's view, gravity is a force that moves particles away from the perfect straight-line paths that they would otherwise follow. In general relativity, gravity is not a force, it is a distortion of the structure of space-time. The usual image is to say that space-time becomes curved, though this term is easily misinterpreted. In particular, it doesn't have to be curved round anything else. The curvature is interpreted physically as the force of gravity, and it causes light rays to bend. One result is gravitational lensing, the bending of light by massive objects, which Einstein discovered in 1911 and published in 1915. The effect was first observed during an eclipse of the sun. More recently, it has been discovered that some distant quasars produce multiple images in telescopes because their light is lensed by an intervening galaxy. Einstein's theory of gravity ousted Newton's because it fitted observations better, but Newton's remains accurate enough for many purposes and is simpler, so it is by no means obsolete. Now it's beginning to look as if Einstein may in turn be ousted, possibly by a theory that he rejected as his greatest mistake. In 1998, two different observations called Einstein's theory into question. One involved the structure of the universe on truly massive scales. The other happened in our own backyard. The first has survived everything so far thrown at it. The second can possibly be traced to something more prosaic. So let's start with the second curious discovery. In 1972 and 1973, two space probes, Pioneer 10 and 11, were launched to study Jupiter and Saturn. By the end of the 1980s, they were in deep space, heading out of the known solar system. There has long been a belief, a scientific legend waiting to happen, that beyond Pluto, there may be an as-yet-undiscovered planet, Planet X. Such a planet would disturb the motions of the two pioneers, so it was worth tracking the probes in the hope of finding unexpected deviations. John Anderson's team found deviations, all right, but they didn't fit Planet X. And they didn't fit general relativity either. The pioneers are coasting, with no active form of propulsion, so the gravity of the Sun, and the much weaker gravity of the other bodies of the known solar system, pulls on them, and gradually slows them down. But the probes were slowing down a tiny bit more than they should have been. In 1994, Michael Martin suggested that this effect had become sufficiently well established that it cast doubt on Einstein's theory. And in 1998, Anderson's team reported that what was observed could not be explained by such effects as instrument error, gas clouds, the push of sunlight, or the gravitational pull of outlying comets. Three other scientists quickly responded by suggesting other things that might explain the anomalies. Two wondered about waste heat. The pioneers are powered by onboard nuclear generators, and they radiate a small amount of surplus heat into space. The pressure of that radiation might slow the craft down by the observed amount. The other possible explanation is that the pioneers may be venting tiny quantities of fuel into space. Anderson thought about these explanations and found problems with them both. The strangest feature of the observed slowing down is that it is precisely what would be predicted by an unorthodox theory suggested in 1983 by Mordechai Milgrom. This theory changes not the law of gravity, but Newton's law of motion, force equals mass times acceleration. Milgrom's modification applies when the acceleration is very small, and it was introduced in order to explain another gravitational puzzle, the fact that galaxies do not rotate at the speeds predicted by either Newton or Einstein. This discrepancy is usually put down to the existence of cold dark matter, which exerts a gravitational pull but can't be seen in telescopes. If galaxies have a halo of cold dark matter, then they will rotate at a speed that is inconsistent with the matter in the visible portions. A lot of theorists dislike cold dark matter because you can't observe it directly. That's what cold dark means. And Milgrom's theory has slowly gained in popularity. Further studies of the pioneers may help decide. The other discovery is about the expansion of the universe. The universe is getting bigger, but it now seems that the very distant universe is expanding faster than it ought to. This startling result, confirmed by later, more detailed studies, comes from the Supernova Cosmology Project headed by Saul Perlmutter and its arch-rival, Hi-Z Supernova Search Team, headed by Brian Schmidt. It shows up as a slight bend in a graph of how a distant supernova's apparent brightness varies with its red shift. According to general relativity, that graph ought to be straight, but it's not. It behaves as if there is some repulsive component to gravity, which only shows up at extremely long distances, say, half the radius of the universe, A form of anti-gravity, in fact. Recent work seems to have confirmed this remarkable discovery. But, as always, ingenious scientists have come up with alternative explanations. In 2001, Chobo Sarki, John Turning and Nemanja Kalapa put forward a totally different theory to explain the observations. They suggest that the light from distant supernovas is dimmer than expected because some of the particles of light, photons, are changing into something else. Specifically, they are changing into axions, hypothetical particles predicted by several of the currently fashionable quantum mechanical theories of particle physics. Axions are not expected to interact much with other matter, which makes it hard to detect them. But if they have a very small but non-zero mass, about 1/16 of that of an electron, then they will interact with intergalactic magnetic fields. This interaction would convert a small fraction of photons into axions, and that would account for the missing light. In fact, the most distant supernovas could lose 1/3 of their photons this way. It is a sobering thought that such a tiny modification of known physics, by introducing a particle whose mass ought to be negligible, could have such a big effect. At any rate, either gravity is not as we thought, or axions exist, as expected, and have mass, not as expected. Or there's a third reason for the observations, which no one has yet thought of. One theory of the repulsive force is an exotic form of matter, quintessence. This word, meaning fifth essence, originally referred to a fifth element after earth, air, fire, and water. On Discworld, this role is played by surprise. This is a form of vacuum energy that pervades all of space and exerts negative pressure. As we write this, we can picture Ridcully's expression. We shall have to ignore it. This isn't something sensible like magic. This is science. Empty space can be full of interest. Curiously, Einstein originally included a repulsive force of this kind in his relativistic equations for gravity. He called it the cosmological constant. Later, he changed his mind and threw the cosmological constant out, complaining that he'd been foolish to include it in the first place. He died thinking it was a blemish on his record, but maybe his original intuition was spot on after all. Unless axions exist and have mass, of course. In Einstein's approach to the cosmological constant, quintessence is effectively spread uniformly throughout space. But suppose it isn't. Ordinary matter is clumpy, not uniform. David Santiago has pointed out that if quintessence is clumpy too, then Einstein's equations predict that the universe could contain anti-black holes that repel matter instead of swallowing it. These are not quite the same as hypothetical white holes, time-reversed black holes which spit matter out. However, it's not yet clear that anti-black holes can be stable. Ordinary matter is clumpy because gravity is an attractive force. It likes to create clumps. Anti-gravity is a repulsive force, and by analogy, it ought to destroy clumps. If that argument is right, then anti-black holes are unstable and would not be able to form in the first place. They would be mathematical solutions of Einstein's equations, but not ones that could be physically realized. Until somebody does the necessary calculations, we can't be sure.